Welcome to Parliament Square. In 2009, the judicial role of the House of Lords was transferred to a newly created Supreme Court of the United Kingdom. This is the final court of appeal for civil appeals from across the UK and for criminal appeals from England, Wales and Northern Ireland. The Law Lords moved from the Houses of Parliament to a new but historic setting just across the square, the former Middlesex Guildhall. Our new home sits at the constitutional heart of the UK. Thanks to the move, all four sides of Parliament Square are now balanced between the bedrocks of the British state. The legislature, in the form of Parliament, the executive, in the form of Her Majesty's Treasury, the established church, in the form of Westminster Abbey, and the judiciary, in the form of this court. The ancient Abbey, of course, was built over many hundreds of years, while the Houses of Parliament are mainly a creation of the High Victorian period. Although this Edwardian building is the youngster of the set, it is a notable and creative contribution to this remarkable place. The site itself, opposite the Abbey, has been linked with the concept of justice for nearly 1,000 years, since the times when those seeking refuge could claim sanctuary within the confines of the Abbey grounds. This particular building dates from 1913. Our tour will follow a clockwise route. It will concentrate on the artistry behind the building and its sculpture, rather than the interior. However, you're more than welcome to visit us inside during our opening hours, which are usually from 9:30 a.m. until 4:30 p.m. on weekdays. Looking down on those passing the highest court in the land are a range of sculptural figures. They celebrate highly prized virtues and tell allegorical tales from history. We will move on to the sculpture by an artist named Henry Fair in a moment. But first, let's pause on the curved stone benches at the front of the court and get an expert account of the architecture. The architect who led the restoration of this Edwardian building in 2010 is Hugh Fielden.
The architect and the architectural style. It was a Scottish architect, James S. Gibson, who designed what was then known as the Middlesex Guildhall in cream-coloured Portland stone. Portland is the same stone used to build St. Paul's Cathedral and the Tower of London. The building has been described as Art Nouveau Gothic, and it's very unusual for its time. In 1913, a number of important new buildings had just arrived in the square, all of them vying for attention with the medieval outlines of Westminster Abbey. As the restoration architect Hugh Fielden explains, Gibson had to make a difficult choice about which style would be best.
He felt that the Gothic was the correct style for the site. To my eye, the tower was designed to balance St. Margaret's Church in its presence around the relatively newly created Parliament Square, which was still evolving. So it creates a western side to Parliament Square in a style that doesn't mimic but has the same ethos as the Gothic at the Palace of Westminster. The Gothic itself is the development of the strict Gothic, and that, I think, is largely down to the sculptor Henry Fair, who was widely regarded at the time as having managed to get away with an awful lot.
There is speculation that a talented young partner in Gibson's firm, Frank Skipwith, did most of the design work. Skipwith was killed in service during the Great War, and we know little about him. The sculptor and the front façade. The front façade of the Supreme Court has a delicately carved deep relief frieze by Henry Charles Fair. Fair was a Londoner, but of Swiss origin. He was part of the new sculpture movement, which wanted to make sculpture more dynamic and fluid. His most famous work today is probably the colossal mermaids above the entrance to Victoria Station. There, the mermaids' tails seem to be dissolving before your very eyes into seaweed. Gibson, the architect, and Fair knew each other well. They'd already worked together on a small number of public buildings. The sculptor seems to have had pretty free rein on this commission, which may be why the work ended up being so imaginative and free-flowing. Take a look at the frieze, which stretches across both sides of the entrance and extends over the distinctive canted bay towers of the front façade. If you move up close, you'll find the sculptor's name chiselled into the top right-hand corner of the entranceway. So, who's who? Above the arch over the main entrance, you'll see Henry III granting a charter to the Abbey of Westminster. As he stands regally on the left, the Abbey's hierarchy lines up to pay him honour. This scene has the utmost symbolic significance. Henry III was the first king ever to call a parliament. His reign was both long and prosperous, and although historians might argue that Henry wasn't so much of the democrat, he designated Westminster as the centre of the royal court. If you look closely at the figure of the king, the carving is amazingly fine. Henry Fair was known for the sharpness and the clarity of his work. Look, for instance, at the embroidery of the robes. Still, some share of the credit should go to Fair's highly skilled stone carver, Carlo Domenico Magnoni. An Italian immigrant, Magnoni has an extraordinary story in his own right, which we'll return to later. Above the king stands a richly carved band of old English heraldic beasts, lions, unicorns, and the mythical half-goat, half-antelope that's called a Yale. They're garlanded with Tudor roses, thistles, shields and arms. The gargoyle figures are four angels of the winds and the four angels of protection. In a Gothic-style niche in the parapet is a figure representing Britannia, and the knightly crest just below that of the Supreme Court's modern coat of arms is that of the County of Middlesex.
Why Middlesex? Why do we see the Middlesex coat of arms on the facade? Gibson's building was originally created as the Guildhall of the County of Middlesex. Just underneath the Middlesex coat of arms, three swords underneath a crown, is a perspective outline of the Great Hall at Hampton Court. Hampton Court is also in Middlesex. Middlesex County Council first came to Parliament Square in 1889. This was not the first building the council commissioned, but it is the most successful. Its Gothic predecessor, one of three court buildings built here in total, lasted less than 20 years. The Guildhall, as it was then known, was not just Middlesex County Council's offices. It also held the quarter sessions, quarterly law courts hearing criminal cases. Later, the building became a crown court, holding separate courtrooms. The County of Middlesex dates from Saxon times, and its coat of arms is made up of three notched swords, topped with a Saxon crown. The savage-looking sword is known as a Ceax, after the Saxons themselves. We'll return to the scene on the right of the tower when we complete the tour. The frieze depicts Lady Jane Grey, who was briefly queen in Tudor times. High above, there are yet more allegorical figures to see.
King John. Centre stage this time is Henry III's father, King John. He's signing a famous document, one that's inspired governments across the world, the Magna Carta. This was at Runnymede near Windsor in 1215. John's tyrannical power had to be checked, and his own noblemen rose against him. We see King John at the moment he is being forced to sign the Magna Carta, the Great Charter of the Liberties of England. You'll notice the expression on the king's face is rather cowed. He's flanked by his supporters, churchmen and monks, one holding a Bible. The barons look sternly on. In the background, waving flags and pennants give a strong sense of depth. One delightful detail is the young page on the right, who has a slightly floppy ankle boot. Each of the barons is wearing detailed chainmail, lovingly chiselled out by Fair's stonemason, Magnoni. The South Facade. As you walk, you'll see a series of carved figures above the windows. Together, they symbolise the arts, science and industry. One contemporary critic said they were
so full of human fancy, they seem to be growing out of the architectural features of the building.
You'll also find a lot of naturalistic decoration, which is typical of both Art Nouveau and the arts and crafts movement. This building is a synthesis of all these influences, with Gothic elements like pointed arches and canopies mixed in with features normally thought of as French Renaissance. Two well-endowed angels form the corbels to the projecting balcony. They are totally unconventional for angels, rather earthy and a lot like ships' figureheads. One bears a shield with scales, the symbol of justice. The other holds an orb and a sceptre, which are symbols of power. It's rare for decorative corbels to project at a right angle like this. The effect is slightly comic and makes the passerby blink nervously. Is justice about to fall on my head? These and the stern-faced male angels are a real surprise after the courtly scenes on the front freeze. The incidental sculpture is also inventive. You'll find a fox sauntering along through tangled vines, tiny mice crawling through thistles, and even a hanging bat. On the second floor windows, there are some magnificent cats with lavishly long whiskers. Sadly, you can't see them from ground level. This kind of playfulness is unusual on a civic building. There's no Gothic gloom and no classical bombast. Instead, there's a tremendous sense of the inventive. This is just what Gibson wanted, a slightly lighter tone. He had to deal with all the competing styles of Parliament Square. He wrote,
"The building should be considered a dainty piece of ornament, set amongst the austere and formal buildings of the neighbourhood. The detail employed, while preserving many of the features and mouldings of the later Gothic, has been imbued with a modern spirit of freshness."
We'll focus on the sculptor, so let's stay on the broad sanctuary or abbey side of the building. The stone carver. The playful figures carved as window keystones are as anarchic as their carver, Carlo Domenico Magnoni. They peep inside the windows, or in some cases, try to escape. Carlo Magnoni must have led a strange life. He spent his 40-plus years in Britain carving statues while being tailed across the country by Italian state spies. He was an anarchist and had been forced to leave Italy because of his political beliefs. Look out for the figure of a sculptor on the far right. There is a guide in your more function. The sculptor has a small model of a statue in one hand. He's concentrating on his job with a frown. It's tempting to think of this as Magnoni's playful portrait of his employer, Henry Fair. As we round the corner, look out for the next pair of window keystones immediately on your right. They are a man and wife engineer and mechanic couple. She fiddles with a sector gear and pinion, and he holds a pair of dividers and a cog. Next in the lineup is the angel of navigation, a star on her brow. She holds an armillary sphere, a model of the skies, and is there to represent astronomy.
When you're ready, continue to walk along the back of the building. On your left is the Queen Elizabeth II Conference Centre, which was built on the site of the former Westminster Hospital. The hospital burned down in 1950.
The figure of truth. The back door of the court is also adorned with sculpture, but the decoration has got simpler here. Most of the people using this back entrance were those being put on trial. So sculptor Henry Fair set out to stress the values of the law. At the top, set in a Gothic with Art Nouveau touches canopy, is Truth. She is blindfold to show that she is indifferent to wealth, privilege, or power. Despite that, she can still obviously see what she needs to see. She is carrying the lamp of truth and is flanked by smaller figures of honesty and justice.
Bridewell Gate. Notice the ancient gateway on the west side of the building. Surely this door is set into railings and not a wall. Yes, this truly is a portal going nowhere. This was once the gateway to a house of correction, the Bridewell. It dates from 1618. The institution was originally just southwest of here, near the Catholic Westminster Cathedral. Bridewell is famous as the first ever house of correction, designed to put the idle but able-bodied poor to work. Beggars, vagrants, and the mentally ill were kept off the streets, rather brutally. Whipping was commonplace, as was solitary confinement. The work included picking apart oakum or hemp rope with bare hands that would soon become bleeding and sore. It was during court sessions that many miscreants, ne'er-do-wells and plain poor people were convicted and sent to Bridewell. So it seems appropriate that when Bridewell was demolished, the gate was rescued and brought here. The sight of that forbidding gate must have been a sombre moment for all the defendants who caught sight of it, guilty or not. Over 35 years as a Crown Court, this building's seven courts dealt with thousands of cases. Defendants, from robbers to fraudsters, would be brought here in the back of a police van. Little Sanctuary. The name of this tiny alley, Little Sanctuary, speaks of a long history. Very long. Ironically, before the first of this site's many courthouses even existed, this was the very spot where medieval fugitives would seek refuge from the law. Hard to imagine, but the land you are standing on was once an island between two rivers, the Tyburn and the Thames. The land has since been drained and reclaimed. Neglected and dank, it was known as Thorny Island because it was full of brambles. It was an obvious place to hide. The reclusive Edward the Confessor lived on the island while he was building Westminster Abbey. Edward, the last Anglo-Saxon King of England, also began work on a remarkable, gloomy fortress. It was right where you're standing now, the Sanctuary Tower. Around 60 feet high and with walls 25 feet thick, the Sanctuary Tower was the obvious choice for those seeking to hide from their enemies. The right to sanctuary was ended in the 17th century. But even in later years, there was still a darker side to the area. Contemporary reports complain that by the 1780s, Westminster was filled with thieves and prostitutes, based around the many inns and taverns. Keep walking and turn right to find yourself at the front of the building again.
Lady Jane Grey. We've now caught up again with the Lady Jane to the right of the entrance. As you can see, her hands are reaching out for the crown. She's at Sion House in Middlesex, the London home of the Duke of Northumberland. This scene parallels that of King John and the barons. Lady Jane Grey is being offered the crown by her father-in-law, the Duke of Northumberland, kneeling. The scheming Northumberland had bullied the dying young king, Edward, to assign the throne to Jane. The rightful heir was Henry VIII's Catholic daughter, Mary Tudor. Jane is known as the Nine Days Queen. She was a tragic pawn in a drawn-out power game. In 1553, she was locked in the Tower of London. Before long, all three main characters you can see in this drama, including Jane's husband, would be beheaded. Fair's Frieze is highly decorative, with Lady Jane as the compelling and romantic figure at its centre. But the scene is also an oblique but definite warning. Do not abuse power and do not attempt to usurp it. Henry Fair was telling us, in his own flamboyant way, that justice will always prevail. And that is what the Supreme Court stands for. As the poem inscribed upon these stone benches says,
here justice sits and lifts her steady scales within the Abbey's sight and Parliament's, but independent of them both, and bound by truth of principle and argument.
We hope you have enjoyed this tour. Goodbye.